HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 164, recorded live Wednesday, June 11th, 2009. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. And by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks Silverlight 3 with Tim Heuer.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. I'm chatting with Tim Heuer today. Tim and I are peers on the same team, and Tim is a community program manager for Silverlight. And I figured there wasn't anyone who knew more about Silverlight 3 than Tim, so I thought it was time to have him on the show. Thanks a lot, Tim, for chatting with me today.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
So for me, because I don't live and breathe Silverlight like you do, it's getting a little confusing where our versioning is getting real fast. I assume Silverlight 4, 5, and 6 are coming soon just because the numbers are changing so quick. What's new in Silverlight 3? Because I'm just now getting my brain around Silverlight 2.
Yeah, I think one of the things I like about Silverlight so far is it's solid versioning, no dot versioning so far. So less confusing, at least. But yeah, we have a really quick iteration process, that, at least one of the quicker ones that I've seen in Microsoft timeframe, at least. And we're coming up on version 3, and some of the significant changes in version 3 are we've added a couple new transforms for things like Perspective 3D. We've made a significant investment in both controls and a framework for making developing line of business applications a little bit easier, and enhancing the control set in general with built-in validation and things like that. Kind of providing the developer a lot more out of the box rather than to have to do a lot of that plumbing code for them. So those are the two areas, or two areas that I think are some of the significant improvements. And of course, there's also general improvements over various new features or various existing features from Silverlight 2, performance, some standard bug fixes, etc. And then the one that feature that people keep talking about is the what we call the out-of-browser feature in Silverlight 3, which is a completely new feature. It didn't exist in 2, so this is an entirely new feature for 3.
A lot of people didn't think that was going to happen. So, you know, Silverlight's always been an in-browser thing, and then Adobe Air kind of came out, and I think most people think of Adobe Air in the context of Twitter clients, which is interesting. It's almost as if Adobe Air is a Twitter client construction set.
Right.
All the big Twitter clients are Air. I wonder if that fact is what pushed us to do it, or if we'd planned it the whole time.
We've been planning it. You know, it was a big customer request to kind of create this desktop-like experience in this cross-platform environment. And our implementation is different from Air as it stands right now. We do still honor the browser security sandbox, and so it's not a full trust environment. But the big difference between the two from an end customer standpoint is there's no additional stuff to download. So with Air, you have to have Flash, and then you have to have the Air runtime as well, and then the application. So with Silverlight, it's if the user has Silverlight and your application wants to take advantage of this out of the browser feature, it literally is actually just one line of code to call that function to take it out of the browser, and there's no additional download that your user has to have. So it's pretty cool in that regard, and it was something that our customers had been requesting, and it'll evolve over time as well. This is kind of the first iteration of the feature, so we already are getting feedback on some things that that customers want out of the feature as well. But it's pretty cool. It's neat to see what people are thinking about. Obviously, that traveling salesman scenario of, you know, pretty much any of the traveling salesman scenario, you know, expense claims, customer visits, orders, that type of thing, fit very well with this kind of thin, smart client, RIA, whatever you want to call it, that can be detached from the browser, run offline, and then kind of go back to the home office and synchronize later.
Is that you said the traveling salesman scenario, like that's totally obvious to me, and that, of course, who else would use Silverlight than traveling salesman? But is that the Is that the scenario that you guys use? Is this a character or a what do you call that when you have a
the persona,
give a name? Like less like, oh, it's Fred the traveling salesman. Yeah. And everyone needs to refer to Fred now, even though he's some archetype.
Yeah, no, we don't have any specific persona. Basically, the three scenarios that feature is trying to, we think it more in scenarios lately than actual people personas, which I guess essentially map to each other. But the three scenarios is kind of like the fully disconnected app. So, you know, you detach an application from the browser and it's not network dependent. You know, you can think of this as a standalone casual game, or that type of thing. Something that we don't care if you're connected or not. The fully connected app. So it still requires internet connection, but it's somewhat of a more desktop like experience. So the one that I like to think about is kind of that Pandora radio concept where, you know, you may not want a whole browser open the entire time, but you have this little application that still essentially is a web-based application, but it's more of a desktop feel. And then the third would be that occasionally connected scenario where if I'm connected, great, use the resources, communicate live data, etc. If I'm not, you know, give me some type of offline storage mechanism that I can communicate, save later, and when I do detect a connection, you know, I can build in logic to do that resolution or synchronization, whatever that may be. So those are the three key areas that out-of-browser is aiming to solve for our customers right now.
So the support that it provides is the frame in which the application lives, the detection of whether it will help you detect if you're online or offline?
Correct.
I'm trying to put this around what my offline experience, which is using Gmail with Google Gears offline.
Right.
And I don't understand how they're able to take these Ajax applications and when they're not connected to the net, they can get to all their resources. And I'm wondering if, are they basically relying on the browser cache for all of these things, these JavaScript files, and how that relates to what we're relying on?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not exactly sure how, I mean, I know what the mechanism of Gears is, but I'm not sure how someone like Google Gmail is taking advantage of that. I'm assuming that they're pushing all their CSS and logic, like you said, down to Gears as well. Ours, one of the benefits of Silverlight is that your application lives in a single entity file. So we call that a ZAP. It's a .xap extension. So when the developer creates this application, you know, they're using Visual Studio, writing managed code, etc., their UI is in XAML. When they hit compile, all that UI and all that logic gets compiled into this ZAP file. So in our out-of-browser scenario, when somebody takes that application to their desktop, offline, detach, whatever the term you want to use, basically we say, okay, we know what that ZAP is, so let's store that in this location. And now we just launch that ZAP when the user double clicks that shortcut on their desktop. So all your logic is already self-contained in that one file, and we don't have to download anything additional. And so we have a hosting model that basically is kind of this launcher that basically says, okay, you know, users detach this application, they have this shortcut on their desktop, double click it, we launch our host and we say, here's the ZAP you need to run, and that becomes the application. And you still get to take advantage of .NET's isolated storage at that point for offline storage mechanism, things like that as well.
What if I had external, what if I'm writing Baby Smash for Silverlight and I want to make it offline, but I have resources that I would go off to the wire to get, like downloading WAV files and movies and things that aren't obvious offline resources?
Yeah, so in that instance, you're dependent a little bit on a connection, so you definitely would want to make sure you take advantage of those APIs to say, hey, can I go do this? But if the assumption is made there that you do have connection, you still have those capabilities. So the standard, you know, web client, HTTP web request calls still exist in the out-of-browser scenario for you to say, you know, go fetch me this resource, load it into in-memory, do whatever. Or you can, you know, still use isolated storage and say, you know, I need to go get this WAV file, store it,
my own cache,
and then later, you know, use it later from isolated storage as well.
Okay. So then, yeah, just drop it and download it when I am online.
Right.
Bring it to isolated storage, and then just, if I'm offline, get it here, get it locally.
Right, right.
Am I able to take advantage of the browser cache? can I tell the browser to download it and then just say if it's in the cache, use it? Or do I have to have my own kind of cache within isolated storage?
You're kind of managing your own cache within isolated storage a little bit. And right now, that's just because of the nature of the way we're hosting the Out of Browser Zap. So we're still using kind of, you know, the platform-specific browser host model. So, but it's in a different enough mechanism that you shouldn't rely on the browser cache.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Okay. Now this, sometimes Microsoft has been criticized and also Java and, you know, browsers, other earlier browsers with this notion of what they call drive-by downloads, which is the, you arrive at a page and something immediately happens, whether a file gets, you know, in the old days, a download would start immediately. And then, and this was a while back, but then the little yellow bar would appear and say, you know, this page is trying to download a file. And then, you know, so some browsers, it's easier to get it to automatically start the download than others because drive-by downloads are not necessarily a good thing. But sometimes people say that Microsoft's click once is a drive-by download. Click once is when you can load a WPF app, like an actual rich application. You do have to click on it and install it and all those kind of things, but If I can suddenly start running applications out of the browser, does that mean I could write a SilverLight virus?
In theory, no. Everything in SilverLight, it's a great thing to point out the differences between click once, especially, and this type of concept. We still honor, so there is no, in SilverLight, there's still no kind of drive-by install. It requires user intent to actually take an application offline. So you can't just type in a URL and boom, you have a SilverLight application offline. You have to, we always start from an in-browser experience and, you know, your application would have a button or some type of command that says, take me offline. So the user is fully aware of what they're doing. The second part is that once it is offline, we're operating still in a secure sandbox. And, the best way to think about it is still the browser secure sandbox. So there's no way that you would be able to access the local file system without the user, again, providing intent through some type of file dialog or something like that. Now, if you have there's no protection from idiot users, right? I mean, if I create this, the wicked cool SilverLightApplication.com and someone thinks it's so great and I say, you know, load your Microsoft Money file and they click the button and load their Microsoft Money file, you know, there's nothing preventing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if it says type in your social security number and they type that, we can't stop it. But arguably, you know, this is kind of a tough one. Maybe there should be, you know, we should protect the idiot user. But my question is that when I run this thing, when I go and pull out my Twitter client, how much do I trust this thing, and can it go and read, you know, C colon whatever? Can it just go anywhere? And what kind of permission, you know, is this thing in a sandbox like Java, or is it like out there in the world doing whatever it wants, like Adobe Air?
No, it is in a low trust environment still, which is kind of one of the benefits that, you know, when you're not actually installing anything, you're kind of putting. We actually put the offline applications are stored in the same location as isolated storage. So it's in this low trust environment. It is in the sandbox. And even in through the open file dialog mechanism, which is how users would provide input for file type data, SilverLight is not aware of the location of that information. The only thing that our runtime allows is we say, okay, the user's provided this c:foo.txt, but we're not telling you it's c:foo.txt. We're just giving the developer a stream that they can read to. So the runtime still is unaware of where that file came from. It's just aware of the bytes of that file. So in that regard, the operating system and the file system specifically is protected. Same thing happens for, you know, writing data through mechanisms like save file dialog. We just give you a stream. We don't allow the developer or the runtime doesn't see, oh, I'm seeing you're trying to save it to c:system32 or something like that.
Right, right. I'm just trying to get a sense around the threat modeling, right? I don't want to show up somewhere and have, and because I have SilverLight, have something evil, you know, hurt me. I don't want applications to like, you know, visit a site, load up SilverLight, SilverLight application leaps out of the other dimension into the offline mode and then hides itself in the tray and squirrels away. And now it's running in the background being evil.
Right. Yeah, we've done a good amount of threat assessment to prevent that specific scenario. And again, you know, this is the first iteration of that particular feature. So whether or not trust levels increase in the future, that's up in the air, you know. But right now, we're in the lowest trust environment. It's a real secure surface. It is in a sandbox, and those type of things shouldn't be possible. If we do think in the future about increasing that trust, you know, we'll typical kind of Microsoft will probably have some type of dialogue or something that requires the user to, you know, authorize that type of action. And in fact, even with isolated storage in Silverlight now, if you go beyond the default limit, you have to request permission from the user to say, I'm going to use more space of your hard drive. Will you allow me to do that? We don't just automatically allow arbitrary writing of gigs of data to isolated storage.
So you actually pop a dialogue and say, you know, I'm willing to give 10 megs to this thing.
Yep. The runtime itself has an API to say, to be able to look and say, what's the current quota for this application? Let's say, and by default, it's 1 meg in the browser, 25 megs out of the browser. And if I know my application is going to need 50 megs, I can say, well, I only have 1 meg available. I'm going to call this API to say, request quota increase, which pops a dialogue to the user saying, your application says it needs this much space. You currently have this much space allocated. Would you like to authorize the increase? And if they say no, it's up to your logic to handle that no. If they say yes, then that increase automatically happens.
Hmm. Okay.
And the user's in complete control of the isolated storage as well. I mean, it's
right.
It's not permastore. You know, it's I can delete it at my will.
So yeah, I assume you need to write your code such that that storage could be deleted in between.
Sure, it shouldn't. It shouldn't really be considered
low trust, isolated scratch space.
Scratch, exactly.
So I've written WPF apps, and I like WPF apps. But now that we've got Silverlight outside of the browser, what message does that say to the WPF programmer? I mean, why would I write anything in WPF now? Why wouldn't I write all of my line of business apps in Silverlight, and now they'll work cross OS?
I think WPF represents the best of breed of our platform, right? Silverlight is both a subset of WPF from the UI standpoint, so a subset of XAML and the presentation framework, as well as a subset of the base class libraries in .NET. So there really is simply things you cannot do in Silverlight as it stands today. As an example, access to anything, device peripherals, or, you know, if you have a scanner in your line of business application, you know, Silverlight directly cannot access that. Whereas WPF in a full trust environment, you could. So there are absolutely scenarios where WPF makes sense. And what I always like to tell people is when they go about developing, you know, a rich client and they're considering Silverlight, my first question is, what's your target platform? And if the target platform is Windows, I say, oh, you should look at WPF. And if they say, well, you know, we really kind of like that web deploy model. Okay, great. You should look at WPF and click once. And then if they, you know, if the question is, you know, we have a customer facing application. We need the broadest potential. We want the richest client on .NET, but we want the broadest reach. Then Silverlight should be considered. But if your target is Windows, and especially for, you know, kind of, behind the firewall, rich line of business applications that may need to do more than what a browser security sandbox would allow, then WPF should really be your first consideration and look at it from that way. The second thing is you could also look at it as a continuum of technologies. So when you look at a lot of thick clients that you use, or at least some that, you know, that I've seen, is there's usually, you know, the biggest and best application, right? Let's even just use Visual Studio, right? So Visual Studio is a behemoth of an application, but it provides incredible features for a developer. But what if we provided some type of, you know, lighter version, maybe just an editor of some sort? You know, is that a mechanism where we can say, well, we don't need the compiler, we don't need .fuscator, we don't need, you know, the build management and things like that. We just want an editor. Could we create an online version using, you know, a subset of those technologies, and that gives us a little bit broader reach? Or the Office scenario, right? What Office is doing with Office and Office Live is actually a good example of that. So thinking of it, I don't think it's a zero-sum game is basically what I'm saying. I think Silverlight represents a continuum to WPF and to other areas of the development platform as well, to even to Windows 7, et cetera. But it also, it doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. Each platform is going to have its sweet spot, for sure. And, you know, that's as of today. You know, in 5-10 years, who knows what the powers that be that are making those decisions, you know, what the platform will look like. But right now, you know, Silverlight's a subset. It's not the full .NET framework. And that has its limitations. The cross-platform and a browser application has its benefits. But you also need to take in consideration, what does my application need to do? You know, how much more code do I have to write to get it there that WPF is already providing me, as an example.
Do you know how to make the possible out of the impossible? Well, the .NET ninjas at Telerik do. They just released a huge pack of web controls all built on top of ASP.NET Ajax that'll help you build impossibly fast and interactive applications in no time at all. They've made the impossible possible in desktop development. If you think you can't have a carousel component in WinForms, well, you can. Their Windows Forms suite features a super powerful grid view control and 32 other crazy desktop components that'll give you dazzling WPF-like features, but in WinForms. They do the same thing in reporting solutions with a new design surface like nothing else. Looks just like graph paper, gives you advanced page layout capabilities, makes it feel more like a graphic design software than a reporting solution. Go check them out at Telerik.com and be a .NET ninja. And thanks for listening.
Couldn't you get into a situation where you'd say, you know, we want a line of business application, we want this and this and this, and Silverlight's looking great, and then somebody says, oh, and it's an absolute requirement that this thing needs to access the scanner. You know, I need Twain, I need WIA, Windows Image Acquisition. And then at that point, you just go, nope, sorry, well, you know, you just hit a spot that Silverlight doesn't do, so no.
Yeah.
Isn't there a way for Silverlight to talk to a local service such that you could, you know, you could make it, you could be talking through your requirements, hit what appears to be an obvious, you know, stopping point. Let's say I want to do an app that does all this great stuff Silverlight does, and it shows videos, and it runs offline, and da-da-da-da, but it also needs to have things scanned in.
Sure.
Could I make a local service so that when I'm running on Windows, Silverlight could say, oh, look, there's that service over there. He'll do the scanning.
Yeah, and actually that's what some people are doing. I'd argue that once you get into that...
I just made that up.
You just made that up? What did you say?
No, I just like totally made that scenario up. I was kind of half kidding. You're saying you can actually have your Silverlight stuff talk to another process that's like sitting around?
Absolutely. I mean, you could have a Windows service that's exposing basically, you know, a WCF endpoint to receive and communicate with command, you know, like a message bus of some sort.
Like a little web server, local web server, and then Silverlight would just talk to that guy.
Right. I mean, Silverlight has supports network sockets, so you can absolutely do that type of thing. But I'd argue once you get into that scenario, if someone is to say, "Well, yeah, we can install a Windows service that talks to the scanner, and then we expose an API to allow it to talk to that," and I would say, "Well, you just added a second install to your application and another dependency."
Yeah.
So, you know, then I would back into that conversation of, does WPF make more sense in this regard? And if they go, well, you know, on Windows, we could use this service, and on other platforms, we still want to have the app available, but they wouldn't have that. Okay, then you're getting into user experience discussion of how are you devaluing your own application on other platforms, you know, if you start making platform-specific decisions.
You know, I see. So that really gets down to the, you know, just because you can do something doesn't mean you necessarily should. And that's, you know, Silverlight has some pretty interesting capabilities, and there's always a way to lash something together with angle brackets and paper clips. But it sounds to me like a solution like that really is more of a WPF solution, because then you get the full framework, you get the full you know, and not just the full framework from a .NET perspective, but everything underneath it, like I just mentioned, WIA, which is a COM interface, and, you know, Twain, which is native, and on and on.
Right, exactly, yeah. Just because, you know, all the hooks are there, but exactly what you said. Just because you can do something doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing to do.
Huh. Now, are we going to get up to, Flash is on what, version 10?
Version 10, yeah.
Are we going to, how quickly can we get to version 10?
We're, October will be version 4, November will be version 5. No, just kidding. Yeah. No, I think, you know, the team has been looking at And if you look at the history, it's really been 12-month iterations so far. And in Microsoft timeframe, mm-hmm. that's pretty fast. I'd like, you know, as a developer, everyone would like it to be faster, I suppose. I guess it's always 50-50. You know, you push things out too fast, people get upset that too much thing is coming, and too slow, it's, you know, not fast enough. But
yeah.
This year-long cycle has seemed to be pretty effective. So right now, I mean, we're already starting planning on Silverlight 4. We're looking at, you know, the forums and what people are requesting. We have our kind of top 10 punch list for things for Silverlight 4 that we want to look at and get feedback on. And I don't, mm-hmm. you know, I don't think it's unreasonable to assume that we're going to follow that same type of iteration pattern. You know, we've made no timeline roadmaps so far for Silverlight 4 as an example, but you know, if history repeats itself, you know, like I said, I don't think it'd be uncommon for us to see a version 4 and another quick iteration like that. And the team okay. is agile enough that, you know, we're allowing that. And we've actually segmented some things to even make those iterations quicker. So things like the Silverlight Toolkit, which has, you know, a lot of the SDK controls, you know, they're an open source project. They're out on CodePlex. So they'll have an update for Silverlight 3 when Silverlight 3 releases. But, you know, if somebody has this cool whiz-bang new Save the World control and they can crank it out in 2 months, there's nothing preventing them from releasing, you know, that control in 2 months. They don't have to wait for Silverlight 4. So really, the team has done a good job kind of segmenting core and controls and other things, and the ecosystem is pretty good to allow even pretty decent innovation in between these major milestones to occur.
I personally have been, this is kind of, you know, you and I coincidentally both kind of work for Microsoft, so sometimes, you know, we get in trouble for saying stuff that we think is pretty true, but even though it's not necessarily the Microsoft party line. But one of the things that's kept me from getting deeply involved in Silverlight is that it seems like to get the development environment set up involves like 8 installs after just getting Visual Studio itself. You know, so it's like Visual Studio, and then at the time that I'm thinking of, it's like, so you get Visual Studio on, you get Service Pack, whatever, and then you have to get the Silverlight tools, you have to get the Silverlight SDK, you get Silverlight itself, da-da-da-da-da. Is this going to get any better? Because the fear of having all this extra stuff stacked on top of my existing Visual Studio install is keeping me from really jumping in. And then by the time I eventually get comfortable enough to do that, there's a new version coming, which involves another new stack of beta stuff.
Right. Yeah, I'm totally with you there. I mean, I think one of the biggest Achilles heel for Microsoft, especially in the developer division, is this, you know, this concept of which we call what's your ship vehicle, right? What's the ship vehicle for product X? And anything developer related, you know, you want Visual Studio to be able to be the editor for that. The problem is, you know, Visual Studio doesn't have fast iterations. You know, they have long iterations with specific service pack requirements and things. And so when you get something like Silverlight and you go, oh, we need to provide tools for Visual Studio, you know, do we wait for VS 2008 SP2 to provide that? Or do we release, you know, the tools out of band, you know, what Microsoft calls out of band? And so when you see, you know, it happens today, right? We have Visual Studio 2008, but we have how many different out of band releases, right? We've got Dynamic Data, we've got ASP MVC, we've got Silverlight. So
they don't all require tooling, though.
They don't all require tooling. You're right. Neither does Silverlight. I mean, neither does .NET for that matter, right? I mean, you could use Notepad and Compiler is all you need.
Yeah, sure. I'm trying to avoid messing up my install. Like sometimes one of the things that I think is a common scenario for programmers who are on Microsoft is that, you know, programmer Fred is working on a project. Then a new, you know, that's using some technology that's well understood, like ASP.NET. Then a new technology comes out and programmer Fred wants to mess with that new technology, but he's afraid that if he installs something on his machine, it will mess up the project he's working on. Does that make sense?
Sure, sure.
So Silverlight for me is always that thing where it's like, you know, I would install it, but I don't know if it's going to mess up my install because I'm working on something now.
Yeah.
And I can't afford to get this thing to mess it up.
you do bring up one good point. I mean, so we've done a couple things to mitigate that a little bit. The first thing we've done for Silverlight is there are a couple pieces, right? I mean, there's the SDK, there's the runtime, and there's the tools. So one of the things that we've done to kind of obfuscate the confusion a little bit is we created one installer. So if you're an actual developer, you have one install, and it does the Visual Studio update, it does the developer runtime, it deploys the SDK, and it creates the project templates in Visual Studio. So you really only have to download one thing. The second thing, though, that you pointed out, which is key to understand, is right now, like say Silverlight 2 is released, and let's say I'm doing Silverlight 2 development, and you have exactly what you just said in your mindset. Well, I kind of want to get into Silverlight 3, but I don't want to mess up what I have, right?
Right, exactly.
Right now, that is somewhat true. Like once you install whatever Silverlight development environment version you have, that's what it is. There's no multi-targeting with VS 2008. So the second you install the Silverlight 3 tools, your machine just became a Silverlight 3 developer machine.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Now that changes in Visual Studio 2010 with multi-targeting support, you know, for the .NET framework. But we also have Silverlight multi-targeting support in Dev 10. It's just something that's not going to happen for 2008. Again, it gets back to those ship cycles of those teams. You know, what kind of investments and priorities are they making? It's not necessarily there's things that are technically holding it back. It's more so timing and resources, and where do you want to put your efforts?
Yeah, okay. I just, if things move so fast, even I get overwhelmed with this stuff.
Yeah.
I'm starting to use a lot more VMs to do these kinds of things, you know? And I'm just trying to think that if you want somebody to see your product and mess with it, even when it's in beta, you know, you can't keep paving your machine when things happen. Now, Silverlight 3, though, sounds more like some improvements, but it's still fundamentally Silverlight. What I'm trying to say is it's not Silverlight 2 plus some stuff, is it? I mean, are they changing the runtime? I mean, or is it just a bunch of extra libraries?
No, it's not. I mean, it is. You know, there are updates to the core, but it's not like it's you shouldn't think of it as like a .NET 3, .NET 4 type thing. Okay. from the core runtime. I hate to say 2 plus, but that is, you know, when you think about how .NET 2 came out, or .NET 3 and 3.5 is probably a better way to think about it.
Well, I mean, the .NET desktop versioning is just crazy.
It's bonkers, yeah.
Totally bonkers.
I like how we've simplified it in Silverlight of just saying, you know, version 2, version 3. But version 3 is, our goal is always backward compatibility. So the end user will have to have, if you're running a version 3 application, they're going to need the new plugin because, you know, you're targeting things that just aren't there in Silverlight 2.
Okay.
But if you have the Silverlight 3 runtime installed and you visit a Silverlight 2 application, it will still work. It's not like it's breaking anything. It's not like you need to have both plugins installed or anything like that. Okay.
So just like Flash, for the most part, if you have the new stuff and you visit a site that uses the old stuff, you won't notice a difference at all.
Correct.
Okay. Huh. All right, what have I forgotten to ask you? I had a list of things, and you've done a pretty good job of addressing them all. What do you think is going to keep Fred the developer from trying Silverlight out? What's in his way?
I look at developers really in two larger buckets. You're a client developer or you're a web developer. And I know that's way oversimplifying it, but let's just oversimplify it for a second. I think for me, some of the coming from the web developer side, doing more web than client, when there was probably two larger hurdling blocks that will not prevent people from getting started, but probably, you know, have their head scratching a little bit. And that's one that, you know, you are in a client environment. Even though it's kind of a web model, when you're doing Silverlight, you're doing client development, and that brings different paradigms than ASP.NET server-side development, right? One of the biggest mm-hmm. ones is asynchronous communication with services. So if you're a web developer and you're just used to adding, you know, add web reference and one line of code I call the web service, the second line of code I use the return of that web service, et cetera. You know, again, that kind of server mentality. This asynchronous mm-hmm. model might be new to you and, you know, might be a little bit of a hurdle to kind of understand, okay, how do I chain events together? How do I effectively use it? In my opinion, it's going to ultimately make you a more well-rounded programmer. But for some, it kind of gets frustrating. It's like, oh, what's this async handler crap I have to deal with now, you know? And then the second thing I would say is probably XAML can be a little intimidating if you are completely unfamiliar with it. And, you know, it is a markup language. It is kind of, you know, analogous to HTML as far as, you know, containers and things like that. But if you haven't completely looked at it, trying to understand the layout mechanism and what you should use where and what, right, might take a little bit of time just to remove that intimidation factor if you haven't looked at it. Now, luckily, you know, again, we have the tools to kind of obfuscate some of that a little bit with like Expression Blend as kind of a UI designer for XAML. But I would say those are kind of some of the things that might get new developers a little concerned off the bat. But other than that, I mean, it's the .NET side of things is the same .NET that a developer would be used to. So if you're doing an ASP.NET today and you're writing C# or VB, it's the same C# and VB that you'd be writing. It's just you don't have all those base class libraries to choose from.
Yeah, the thing that is the most difficult for me when working in Silverlight or in WPF is always the what can I do in XAML and markup versus what I can do in code behind. I mean, literally just yesterday I was talking to a buddy of mine who was doing some text that was going to fade away and then fade back in. And I said, oh, cool, you could probably do that as a XAML animation. And he's like, you know, I just did it in code behind. And it was really interesting. It was interesting because he was really apologetic. And he's like, oh, you know. But I understood what was going on. I mean, code behind made sense. I understood how to make a timer and make this thing fade away. I know I could do it in XAML, but, you know, who wants to go through the hassle?
Right.
So it seems like the getting over the hump on XAML is a big problem for everybody.
Yeah, and you know, there's still going to always be two types, right? I mean, you could write an ASP.NET application that just has a single placeholder control, right, and just dynamically inject things all day long. But does it, you know, does it make sense? I mean, if you're a hardcore developer and you'd rather live in code, you can certainly do that. I think that's kind of the benefit of our platform is, you know, we have this thing called XAML that you can represent, you know, UI elements as angle brackets and things, but they're this, you can still represent them as code. And I mean, they are objects themselves. Really XAML, I mean, if you look at XAML and a tag like button, the button tag in XAML is nothing more than an instantiation command. I mean, it's new, you know, effectively it's new button. That's what that angle bracket button means. So, you know, that's kind of a weird way to think about it, but that's really what's happening behind the scenes. But yeah, I mean, I think that can be a challenge, especially when you're the sole developer and you don't have this kind of designer developer workflow that we keep talking about, that you're trying to figure out how can I get from A to B quickly? And, oh, I know how to do that in code. I'll just do it in code. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. That type of thinking. I think, you know, the challenges you'll face is, once you start hitting into maybe certain types of pattern development, or now you've added another team member or another UI view that you have to integrate with, you know, how does that code work with the rest of your application? But I don't necessarily think there's anything wrong with that way of thinking. And in fact, we tell people, you know, you can create a button in XAML or you can create it in code. We don't care.
I think that you don't care because it works. But with all things, there's an intrinsic sense of the aesthetic. And I've always felt that with XAML, with WPF, with Silverlight, there's always a, for some reason, somewhere up along the process, it gets started that if you can do it in XAML, that's more impressive, that's somehow better, which I don't quite understand because it's harder to debug. If something goes wrong, it's not like you're going to drop into the code and in a friendly breakpoint, you know. So I'm still trying to get my head around when it's time to just cut bait and let it happen in the code behind. And I feel dirty when I do it.
Yeah, and that's where some of these patterns are emerging, right? So one of the more popular patterns in XAML development, both WPF and Silverlight, is this model view view model pattern. That kind of is this guideline or pattern that talks about, you know, you really shouldn't put any type of UI logic in your code area, right? I mean, you should have this thing called a view, and that represents literally the view of your UI, and it has your UI elements. And the view model is this kind of glue that is the code that talks to and does the data binding and et cetera. And that view model is the thing that becomes more testable, easier to debug, that you're not coupling it with, you know, just kind of this two-tier, tier is probably not the best word, but you know, code behind kind of approach type thing. So the, you know, that the view model approach is one pattern that's emerging to try to solve or try to provide better guidance on that type of development problem that you just mentioned. You know, how do I, where is the best place to put things, and how do I make it the most productive development environment for me, both in creation as well as debugging and maintenance as well.
Yeah. We should do another talk at some point about the kind of this, the code smell, because I'm finding more and more and more as I start doing work with more and more diverse amounts of technology that I sometimes I get paralyzed with, you know, an inability to move forward because I can't come up with a way to make something aesthetically correct. I can't get the code to the point where it doesn't make me want to barf.
It works, but it doesn't make you feel right, right?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Tim. I really appreciate you sitting down and taking the time to talk to me about Silverlight 3.
Oh, thanks, Trey.
And hopefully I'll get you back on when we talk about Silverlight 4.
Absolutely.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.